Hi, and welcome to All Go First. I'm your host, Jessica Minhas. On today's episode, Tiffany Yu joins us. She is the founder of Diversability, a nonprofit dedicated to raising the voices of the disabled community. Tiffany was involved in a deadly car accident with her family when she was just a child, and she has permanent damage to her right arm. She talks about processing her physical disability, the narratives we create around shame, silence, and judgment, and how she's learned how to offer forgiveness to herself. I'm really excited for you to hear this episode. It was really uplifting and meaningful. Let's get started. Hi, Tiffany.
Hi, Jess. How are you?
Gosh, it has been kind of crazy out there right now.
Sorry, I remember that's a little bit of a loaded question.
Yeah, right now, Tiffany, you are in SF and I am here in New York. I'm really excited to do this conversation with you. I think it's so relevant right now. But let me give you just the quick intro on my end, and then I'd love for you to just build it out a little bit on your end. But Tiffany Yu, welcome. You are the founder of Diversability, a social enterprise raising disability awareness and reshaping conceptions of ability. Can you unpack that a little bit more? I want you to do the justice it deserves.
Sure. I think there are two things I'll say. One is really around the celebration of the diversity of the disability lived experience. So how can we acknowledge and feel powerful and strong and brave and courageous in our disability identity? And then the second part of that to me is really around democratizing visibility. You know, who allows us to determine whose stories need to be told? When we first started Diversability, it was, how can we use disability as the reason to belong, or as a reason to belong, not the reason to exclude?
What is the response from people who don't have a disability?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that when I think about the models through which most people talk about disability, there are three main ones. So the first is what's called the medical model. And for people who are unfamiliar with my story, I got into a car accident as a kid. My dad unfortunately passed away in the accident, and I paralyzed my right arm. So I have a type of a spinal cord injury called a brachial plexus injury. The brachial plexus is the name of the nerves in the back of your neck. The reason why I bring that up is because from a medical model, and whenever I go to the doctor's office or I go to physical therapy, it's all around treatment plans for my brachial plexus injury. Or, you know, it's very much like, I'm the doctor, here's your prescription, hand that to you, and you know what your treatment plan is supposed to be. The second is what's called the charity tragedy model, which is actually how most non-disabled people frame disability, which is disability is less than disability, and this is what we're trying to tackle as well. Disability is seen as a bad word. Wow. And when we talk about language, a lot of what we're seeing right now is people are using disability terms in a bad way, right? So like describing the pandemic as crazy, or saying like, I'm feeling paralyzed right now, or I don't want this to fall on deaf ears, you know? Or like, I have a blind spot. So kind of just thinking, and we honestly, we use all of these in the diversity and inclusion world, like so much. And how can we reframe the fact that deaf, being blind, having paralysis, like none of those are bad things? How can we make them neutral to empowering terms? So anyway, so the reason why I bring up this second model, which is the charity tragedy model, is whenever I talk to non-disabled people, most of the lens through which media and everything has been framed has been through this model. Like, oh my gosh, look at this person with cerebral palsy who ran a marathon despite his disability. Again, the despite rather than the because of, right? And then the last is what's called the social model, which is this whole idea that disability was only created because of the way our physical infrastructure was, or mental models or attitudes around disability. And a lot of what you see most progressive disability movements sitting in is in that social model, because it gives you some hope that things can be changed, right? A physical environment can be changed. Mental and attitudes and perceptions can be changed as well. But what I wanted to do was really kind of center ourselves in a disability-centric model, which is how can we really build out views and perceptions of disability out of lived experience, out of pride for identity, and more of these empowering narratives. So I will say most people, most non-disabled people are very supportive of our work because they will say things like, oh, what you're doing is so great. And what's interesting is I started Diversability because I really wanted to root myself in community as a disabled person. I didn't know any disabled people growing up, you know? And so I never thought about what I was doing as good. I was doing it because I needed it for myself. Someone asked me the other day, they said, do you feel like Diversability is still part of your healing process? Because the first time I ever told anyone about the car accident was in the process of forming Diversability in 2009.
That's a long time.
That's a long time.
How long is that?
So the car accident happened in 1997. And the first time I ever told anyone about it was 12 years later. And
just a visual for the audience members, your arm, is it the right one or the left one?
Yeah. So my right arm, there's muscle atrophy that's happened. The accident happened when I was 9. So the hand and the arm, my arms are different lengths, and the hand after a period of non-use will start to hyperextend. So my fingers are hyperextended at the knuckles. You can definitely tell there's been muscle atrophy. I mean, my body is pretty lean anyway, but you can definitely tell that I have a brachial plexus injury. And so when people would ask, I'd start crying. Or people wouldn't ask because they could notice how uncomfortable I felt. And a big part of this is shame.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. That's actually something I wanted to kind of explore on this episode, was this idea of shame and I guess also isolation. So when I hear you talking about what happened in your childhood, you're also from an Asian American family, and you just mentioned that there weren't many Asian Americans in your community. So I can only imagine how isolating this all must have been for you right after the accident.
I think what's interesting is that even if there were other Asian Americans that I could talk to, there is so much discrimination against other parts of my identity and other parts of my experience that we couldn't shed light on, if that makes sense. So if I go into, there are kind of like three big parts that I have now been explaining to people about what it's like to be the daughter of a refugee from the Vietnam War and an immigrant from Taiwan. Yeah. So the first area of shame is the fact that there was a car accident. There was a traumatic car accident. Mental health, trauma are not really acknowledged within, or weren't really acknowledged within my family, because within my family, as an individual within that family, we want to do whatever we can not to cause shame to our family.
Do you feel like that's just your family, or is it kind of, I think about different cultures and I feel like that is kind of a narrative. I feel like it's a narrative in general, but do you feel like it's a more clear, I guess, something that's more shared within the Asian American community?
I think it is shared. I'm always hesitant around making sweeping generalizations.
Yeah, good point.
I will often include this when I write, where I say, I'm just sharing this as this is my experience in my family, and this may resonate with you if you also grew up in an Asian immigrant family, and it may not as well. But this is what I experienced and how I internalized this experience. But yeah, I think what's interesting is so much of what I spent this year, 2020, doing is really, so my word for this year is unlearning. And when I came into this year, it was really around the unlearning of all of the things about being Asian that caused shame around different parts of this disability, this trauma, this grief experience. I actually see unlearning now manifesting in my life in different ways, in terms of anti-Black racism that we see within the Asian community, anti-Black racism we see within the disability community as well, and even confronting my own unlearning that I need to do there. So then there's this trauma part. Then the second was death. And for those who have seen The Farewell, which is this film with this actress Awkwafina, it's about how they know that the grandmother in the family is going to die, but nobody tells her. When I first saw that film, it was the first time I saw such a realistic depiction of an aspect of how I grew up. No one wants to talk about it. And so my mom would tell everyone that my dad was away on a trip.
No way.
Yeah. And so as a 9-year-old girl who's growing up, I know what happened.
Shocked. Yeah.
And unfortunately, I haven't spent that much time around my mom recently, and that may be a different discussion, but the last time I was with her and she was with friends was maybe around like 2015, and she still said her husband was away on a trip.
What does everyone else say in the room when she says that? They just go along with it, nod and go along with it?
That's a great question. I don't think these are like framed in terms of large public events, right? It's just her grabbing lunch or something with a friend and she just so happened to bring her daughter. Oftentimes it's like a stranger, someone who doesn't know the intricacies of what happened. So that's why I didn't talk about it for 12 years, right? Which is outside of our immediate family and, you know, the kids I went to school with, it was kind of like on a need to know basis.
How do you feel you changed as a kid before? Who were you before the accident and how were you after, personality-wise? Or can you paint a picture for us of what like 13-year-old Tiffany is like going into puberty with all this stuff that has happened?
So 13-year-old Tiffany was now 4 years after the car accident. But I think pre-car accident, I feel like I was like kind of like a popular kid and I was a little bit mean.
No way.
I know. And I have this memory of a Korean kid in my class whose last name was Suh, S-U-H. And I would call him She. And I actually got called into the principal's office because of that. And I do remember that. And I wonder if this car accident was a humbling experience for me to really, I don't want to say switch roles, but really see that the way I was moving about my life again, was putting people on a hierarchy, right? If we think about what ableism is, if we think about what sexism, racism are, they're all rooted in these ideas that we think we're better than someone else. And so 13-year-old Tiffany, I mean, I wore long sleeves all the time and I just felt small. I felt really small. I mean, I am a petite woman in general. And I think what's interesting to see the change now is when I meet a lot of people, they're like, Tiffany, the way that you speak and the way you present yourself, it has so much confidence in it. And I start to wonder if maybe there's some narrative in there that was like, if I couldn't use my body, if my body was small, then my voice needed to be big.
I kind of love that, though, because I feel like discovering that you have a strong voice as a kid is so valuable.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I discovered that voice had to be in 2009. Because if you think about shame, right? Or if I think about shame in my own narrative, because I was getting so many, and then the last part of the shame was disability, right? If there's a disability in your family, if there's a death in your family, if there's trauma, it meant that something was wrong with the family. So you don't want to tell anyone about those things. You want to silence them. And then if you think about 9-year-old, 13-year-old Tiffany, I'm carrying around all of these things I can't talk about because I don't want to cause shame to my family.
That was actually my next question. Like, how are you engaging at home? Because I can't imagine that must be so much. Again, I just guess I'm putting myself in your shoes and I just would feel so alone because I wouldn't be able to talk. Well, let me rephrase actually, because that did kind of happen in my house. Mm. I grew up with my grandfather and my grandmother passed when I was 9 and he was so grief-stricken, it was something that we just didn't talk about. And for me, it made everything worse. And it made me feel like there was something broken about me because I felt bad about it. Even though that's totally natural. As an adult, I can see that.
Yeah. I think everything you said totally resonates. I felt so alone. I wrote an essay earlier this year, which has not gone public, but I wrote about what it felt like to grow up in what I'm calling my bedroom prison. Because I never left my bedroom and only to eat. And, you know, I think there's a big part of this where my mom is the real hero because I never saw her grief. Or maybe that's to my detriment. She was so strong. She worked her butt off to raise 4 kids on her own, 4 young kids. Wow, 4 we were kids. 9 to 14 at the time.
I can't imagine.
But she worked so hard, which also meant she was never home, which also meant from an emotional perspective, I just had no support. So from a physical basic needs perspective, I always had a roof over my head. You know, I could feel safe in my home. I grew up in a very affluent, white dominated city in Maryland suburbia, public school, never had my safety threatened, but just internally was not well.
Were you able to talk about it with your siblings at all?
We have not yet collectively healed, is how I'll put it. So one of my brothers and my sister were also in the car with me. And I remember a couple memories growing up where I would say something to my brother who was in the car with me. And he would say, "You're just saying that because you think you're better than me." Or there was a situation. So now I'm more public facing. And my brother who was also in the car with me, now we're, you know, in our 30s. He's like, "Tiffany, you're a fraud. I don't understand why anyone would pay you."
Where do you think that's coming from? I'm like trying to follow the mindset.
Part of it is so much of my work. I call myself like a disability practitioner, right? I'm not a scholar. I haven't like studied disability studies. I'm still learning all of the history.
But your lived experience is so
correct. So rich. So I have the lived experience, but he also has lived experience. Why am I being valued and he not? And of course, this is just me projecting. I think the biggest thing is that for me, the creation of diverse ability was my healing. I needed because I didn't feel like seeking professional mental health support was an option for me. So I turned toward creating a club in college based around this identity. Then once I started to talk to more people, you know, the first time I ever went to a therapist was 2017. That's 20 years.
Why did you feel, I mean, I say wow, because I'm just thinking about how much time you were on your own emotionally and then the dynamics between your siblings. It just grieves my heart a little bit for you and for young Tiffany.
Yeah, sometimes I'll watch videos of me sharing the story of the car accident and I'll cry. And I don't cry in the delivery of it because I think I have learned how to retell the trauma, not relive it, which I think is a very important distinction. But sometimes I watch those videos and I cannot believe how alone she was. And a lot of the work I'm doing now is what did 9-year-old Tiffany need? What does 9-year-old Tiffany need?
Oh my gosh, I know. I'm doing that same work as well. The inner child work. For me, it's been really hard to relate and not be angry. And it's weird because I know as an adult, I hear you talking about your experience and I'm like, oh my gosh, if I was there, how I would have comforted you and all of that. But then when I think of me as a kid and being isolated, I have like a resentment towards it, which doesn't make any logical sense at all.
A resentment toward people wanting to soothe you or having to self-soothe?
No, towards myself, like towards my kid self for some reason.
Interesting. Yeah, I have a little bit of that as well. I am learning what it looks like to forgive myself and have a little bit more compassion for myself because I feel very strong and powerful in my narrative if you haven't figured that out already. But I have a lot of insecurities around the physical manifestation of my disability on my body. And why didn't I keep up my physical therapy? Why did I only decide in 2018 that it was time to start exercising my injured arm? And I think what I keep reminding myself of is 9-year-old Tiffany or inner child Tiffany, she was doing whatever she needed to do to survive. Whatever she thought she was doing was the best thing for her to be doing then. And oftentimes I'll look at my mom, and the reason why I keep saying she's a hero, because I know I have an internal narrative that said you weren't there to support me. I had all the other forms of basic support except emotional support. And all 9-year-old Tiffany wanted is for someone to see her in her grief, for someone to see and acknowledge and validate what she had been through and that it was real. And that validation didn't come until 2009, you know, until the 12 years after where I said, you know what, I can't hide all of this stuff anymore. It's too much for a young person to carry. I need to tell someone that this is real and that this happened.
Gosh, there's a lot to hold there.
It's a lot.
Man.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what self-forgiveness has looked like? I know I'm really struggling with that and I'm definitely struggling with the guilt a lot as well. And my adult self can decouple those two and see the rationale in it. But it definitely, as I'm doing the hard work right now in counseling and just on myself and wanting to grow as a person, I can see how it infiltrates. Like, it's like a little fog and cloud that is on everything I do. And I know, and I don't know if anyone listening is struggling with this or not, but I am so frustrated with myself. And I just, how are you approaching the self-forgiveness and the guilt part?
That is a great question. I think a couple narratives, I guess two things I always come back to is I look at the environment that 9-year-old Tiffany grew up in. And I call her, I think what's interesting is 9-year-old Tiffany was actually quite confident. And I did this exercise with my therapist where she had me run through what the internal narrative was for 9-year-old Tiffany as she was sitting in the car, as all of the events were happening. My therapist was like, can you tell 9-year-old Tiffany that she's going to be okay? Things are going to be hard, but it's all going to get better. And what I told her, and I had my eyes closed and I was envisioning what 9-year-old Tiffany was thinking, and 9-year-old Tiffany would have responded to that messaging being like, what are you talking about? Like, why are you even saying something like that to me? Because 9-year-old Tiffany felt like she was a superhero. Like, she was like, I don't understand why my dad is having a spasm right now. And then like a helicopter took me to the hospital and he kept forcing my eyelids open to just make sure that I was conscious. But 9-year-old Tiffany was like, why are you trying to wake me up? I'm so tired. You know, it's kind of like this, you know, this little angsty little girl who you couldn't tell her the messaging that things were going to be okay because she wasn't yet in a place to understand that things were not okay. And so the two things I was going to bring up was, one is I look back at that 9-year-old girl, or I look back at this 12-year period where I felt so consumed by shame. And shame festers when it is secret and silent and there's judgment involved. And so because all of those things were happening, right, and I hear you, I sense a lot of judgment in the narrative that you're sharing around your own self-compassion journey.
Totally. That's completely spot on. Yeah. And I feel like a jerk to myself. I just don't know how to figure it out.
But it's looking at those time points, right? If I look at like 2014, 2015 Tiffany compared to 2020 Tiffany, I can see that how much work she has done to try and detangle herself from defining herself by this trauma. And a question I got asked by another friend who he had a really difficult upbringing as well. And he asked me a question. He said, how much are you willing to grow out of your trauma? Like, how much is it defining you? And how much are you willing to just let it go? So he's probably like, you know, these like people who are overly positive.
Yes.
He's one of those people. And there was something about him that kind of annoyed me because
I'm saying yes, like, yes. They're like morning people to me as well. Like, both are on the same. But definitely, it's so frustrating for me because I'm like, I could possibly think my way out of this scenario. I would have.
Yeah. What I thought was really humbling about this interaction was and of course, this is not the oppression Olympics. He's been through some hard stuff and I've been through some hard stuff. The way he viewed his hard stuff was he always viewed it as a phase. The way I viewed my hard stuff was, I'm so caught in this, I don't even know how I'm going to get out. I can't even see the light. I just took a course on LinkedIn about building resilience, and I thought one of the interesting tactical skills or practices that she asked us to do was to put ourselves in situations where there's a risk that the answer is no. So an example could be asking for a flight upgrade when you go fly, whenever that is.
That sounds so scary to me.
For me, it was, I went out on a date with a guy recently and I texted him and told him I wanted to see him again. And he responded and said that he thought I was really cool, but didn't think that it was going to work out in that way. And I remember journaling about it that night because I was kind of sad, but I was like, you know, I just took this resilience class and I put myself out there, right? Vulnerability. And the outcome was not what I wanted, but I don't regret the action. So I bring that up too, because I'm also really inspired by this quote that says, you know, you have overcome 100% of the obstacles that have come your way. And honestly, I hate that word overcoming because people will often tell me that I've like overcome my disability, and I'm like, my arm is still paralyzed, like, or like have overcome adversity. But I'm also like, yeah, I think the compassion also comes from the fact that I'm still here. So the second part was like, not everyone made it out of the car accident alive. My dad lost his life. My brother was also in the car. My sister was also in the car. Our lives all look very different. And I feel like I have done so much internal work that I can say I'm thriving. And honestly, this is part of what we want to do at Diversibility as well, right? Which is like, how can we thrive and be disabled? How can we be well and be disabled? You know, and I think part of why our experiences dehumanize as a disabled person is people think that we can only be a victim and we can only be sad and our lives are so hard. And I want to acknowledge that those things are still there. But I wonder if in the creation of Diversibility, I just wanted to like over index on the other side. How can I show the world that I am a happy person, that I can be happy and be disabled as well, right? And I wonder if part of this like fake it until you make it was like, you know, I'm going around prancing around and traveling and all this stuff. And now I feel like I'm actually channeling some of that.
How do you feel like you've been able to unmask shame?
That's a great question. So I've been sitting on shame a lot. And again, the three things, you know, the judgment, the silence, and the secrecy. And as I mentioned earlier, I have a lot of insecurities around how my disabled arm looks. And what I've been doing is I've been posting pictures showing my disabled arm in its full glory. And I'm just trying to give voice to all of the things that cause me shame, because I'm really caught up on the silence part. And I get a lot of questions about bullying. I recently joined a group of people who all have brachial plexus injuries, whether they're from birth or acquired later in life. And the biggest thing that kids, I want to say like 9, you know, 8 to 13 are around bullies. And it's hard to tell a kid who's being bullied to just, you know, love yourself and it's all going to get better, right? It's like this positivity porn messaging.
Oh my gosh, I've never heard that before. Positivity porn?
Positivity porn.
I love that so much. I love that so much.
Yeah. Even during COVID, we've gotten a lot of positivity porn.
Thank you for saying that, because I feel, again, so frustrated. This is part of my judgment that I'm working, self-judgment that I'm working through. But yeah, like I said earlier, I feel frustrated with myself that I can't just positive think my way out of my own self-perception, or my gosh, we're going through so much as a nation right now, COVID. And then also right now, Tiffany and I are talking on the 10th day of national race riots. So there's a lot of collective trauma happening. And yeah, the positivity porn has personally been really hard for me.
Yeah. Can I share a brief story around?
Absolutely. Yes.
Around negative thinking. So in February, I climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, and our porters and our guides, who were all Tanzanian on the trip, they gave us a list of rules. And the number one rule was to be positive. And I kept telling myself, I kept trying to these positive affirmations for myself, like, Tiffany, you got this, you can do this. They have a phrase called pole pole, which means like slowly, slowly, one step at a time. And I kept trying to be more positive, but I feel like I got a reputation in my travel group that I was just like the negative Nancy, because my real narrative was, this is effing miserable. Why did I even decide to do this? How come you didn't train enough? What makes you think you can even show up here? You know, like, why are you even doing this? So everything was negative. And I just knew. And on the day before our summit, so it was a 5-day hike, on the day before we summited to the peak, I was 70% confident that I was not going to make it to the top. I just knew. I just knew that I wasn't. And again, it was all this narrative. But I did. And what was interesting was when I came back, I talked to my therapist and I said, I'm really confused because I keep trying to positively affirm myself, but my internal narrative is so negative. And my therapist was like, Tiffany, what's interesting is you don't let your negative narrative stop you from taking action. So despite all of this self-doubt, negative self-talk, you still did it, right? And then she's also like, none of us are going to be positive all the time. But I think I keep revisiting that as well, is I know, similar to you, Jess, that my internal narrative is negative. You know, after this guy sent me this text, I'm like, is anyone going to want to date a disabled woman? Am I too into social justice that it's hard for people to relate to me? Am I too different to be in Silicon Valley where everyone is driven by like tech and valuations, and I just want to make this city better for disabled people? And those are all my narratives, but yet I'm like still on the apps and I'm still trying to meet people. So I think that the action that matters. I think that you and I, unfortunately, maybe fortunately, may always sit in that place because that's how we grew up, right? And there's a TED Talk I really like from the California Surgeon General named Nadine Burke Harris. And you may be familiar with her work, but she's done a lot of work around adverse childhood experiences and their impact on your brain development. So if you're telling me that you were experiencing grief at 9, as I was, we both had traumatic experiences, our brains were so malleable then that is the lens through which we see the world.
I've never thought about that's kind of the ingrained neurological component, because I'm familiar with trauma, of course, but wow, that I see the world through grief and all the other dynamics.
So yeah, it's like, how can I balance the fact that I know the internal dialogue is this, but then how can I balance the positivity porn with acknowledging that things have been hard, right?
It sounds like you've just really created this community of collective healing, which is so important and so valuable. And I think that we've heard from listeners that it's been really hard to build community. But one thing that you really show to us as an example is that you can build your own community. If you can't find it, build it yourself and figure out a way.
This is really at the root of diversibility, which is we are so isolated and excluded. Can being rooted in community be the thing? Maybe advocacy is a part of it. Maybe, you know, being a support group is part of it. But how can we create community around this identity?
It sounds like you really got a chance to see yourself in other people.
Yeah. I mean, I think the idea of mirrors is so important. Seeing people who are reflected back at you, right?
Yeah, I love that so much.
And honestly, I'm thinking about it now, but I think when I decided to start this disability club, it was mainly seeing me mirrored back to myself in terms of the pie. Because at the time, I didn't know any other disabled people at the time. But I still remember the first time I shared my story publicly, and I cried the first time I shared that story, October 22nd, 2009. And the next couple of times I shared, I also cried. And I recently met a professor at Berkeley who's blind, and she told me that oftentimes when she meets disabled students, they will come up to her and tell her parts of their story, and they'll cry. And what she tells them is that they need to keep telling that story until they stop crying. Because the crying is where the shame is. We're crying because we're ashamed or embarrassed about something.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of so many other ways that comes, that expresses itself in my own personal life, for sure.
Yeah.
Just the abuse, the sexual assault. Like, I feel like you're hitting on such a relatable point around dealing with our shame and where that grief comes from.
And I think it needs to be done in safe containers.
For sure, yeah. How do you know when you found a safe container?
That's such a hard question. I'm sorry, I'm just like laughing and kind of smiling because honestly, I don't think I knew what safe felt like until 2017. And I know we talked about safety earlier and how I grew up. Like, I grew up in very white Maryland suburbia, but I was in my bedroom prison. Mm-hmm. I didn't have outlets to express what I needed, and I had no outlets for healing. And I'm still friends with someone who went to elementary school with me, and I told him that as I was cleaning up my childhood bedroom, I found cards that were written to me by all of my classmates when I was in fourth grade and I was still at the hospital. So I was at the hospital for 3 weeks because I had also broken my leg, so I couldn't walk at the time. And I didn't go back to school until 4 months later. So I was homeschooled for 4 months as I relearned how to walk and relearned how to write with my left hand. And I remember catching up with him maybe about a year or two ago. And I was like, hey, I found these cards that you guys all wrote me, you know, back in 97 when I was at the hospital. And he's like, you know, Tiffany, none of us knew what to say, right? I mean, we're 9 years old. What do you say to someone who now is disabled, who lost a parent, and at that time, you know, probably not that many separated parents as well? And even if there were, nobody knows what to say. Yeah, I think that's a lot to put on a 9-year-old.
For sure.
Even now it's hard. And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about, so as you mentioned, we're kind of in like day 10 of these protests, is the fact that I found a stat earlier today that over half of Black disabled people will be arrested by the time they're in their late 20s. And the reason why I think about that is because if I were in a situation where someone said, put up your hands, or put your hands against the wall, I can't, you know, I can only do one. And right. If escalation is the first thing. So in that scenario, I pass as a non-disabled person, right? I've been thinking a lot about what it means to like pass as a non-disabled person. And in these scenarios, they may just be racially charged unless that person is a wheelchair user or has something very visible. In that scenario, they're passing as a non-disabled person who is not listening to a police command. So that's why.
I didn't even think about that.
So the reason why I brought that up is because I wear a splint on my hand now sometimes. And I was thinking about, I originally got it because my knuckles are like hyperextended, but I was thinking about what the visual marker means to the rest of the world in scenarios like that, or when someone offers to give me their seat on the bus, because normally someone would not, right? If I'm carrying a lot of things. So what does it mean for something to be visible versus not visible, for something to be visible, but to be able to pass? I had an artist draw on my splint, and he drew a picture of a 9-year-old girl hugging an elephant, because I always felt like my arm was the elephant in the room, or at least that's what my internal narrative was. And I felt like everyone was staring, but no one was asking. And then when people would ask, I would cry. So the artwork on the splint is 9-year-old Tiffany finally embracing hugging this elephant. I had him write the word proud on one of the straps. And it's a reminder to me, and this goes back to your earlier question around, you know, what does like self-forgiveness and compassion look like? And, you know, when I think about these ACE scores or these adverse childhood experiences, and I look at potential outcomes and I look at where we are, that is enough to be proud. Now that I have this splint that has artwork on it, how do you get over the shame of like the body insecurity with a body that looks different? Is people are like, oh, what's on your splint? And now I can tell them this whole story. Now my arm is a piece of art. Now I can say, this is my time for my arm to stop being hidden under these long sleeve hoodies. I mean, I literally wore the same long sleeved, it was like this white zipper track jacket looking thing. I literally wore it every single day. And by doing things like that, it's just allowing shame to fester. That's what secrecy looked like for me on the physical manifestation of my body.
You're so wise, Tiffany, and you have so much wisdom in everything that you've come through. You've just able to articulate it so well, and you're such an amazing teacher. You have said before that you have asked yourself, how can I believe in all the things I accomplished? How can you believe in all the things you've accomplished? How have you done that?
I really don't. I summited Mount Kilimanjaro, and I still cannot believe it. I still cannot believe that people resonate with Diverse Abilities' message. I can't believe that I have done the internal work to feel like I have really healed from this car accident. I think there are other stressors and other little T traumas that I have to work through. But I keep coming back to this word proud. I'm just so proud of who I am. And I redefined success recently. And these days, success is, do I like what I see in the mirror? But what that means to me is, do I like how I'm showing up in the world? Am I showing up with integrity? Am I showing up as authentically as I can? Am I showing up by not regretting the action, but maybe being disappointed by the outcome, and that's okay? And if I am disappointed, reminding myself that at least I took the action and that it's building my resilience muscle. But I mean, I think the first big believe that I needed was I needed to believe that my story was real and I needed it to be validated by someone else. I needed someone else to see me in that hurt. And coming back to the beginning of this conversation of democratizing storytelling, right? I felt like in those 12 years of not telling anyone about this car accident, I felt like my story didn't deserve to be told. It needed to be hidden. Who would care? And I think the reason why I feel so rooted and grounded in our mission at Diversability is because I look at myself as the example of the fact that when you acknowledge that your story matters, then you can show up in the world. Yeah, then you can show up in the world and like who you're showing up as. Because how liberating is it to just be yourself? I cannot tell you how liberating it is to not have to feel like I'm hiding. But the real message is just how can all of us just be more of ourselves?
How can we do that? How do we do that?
Again, it's the shame. It's like, how can we give voice to the things that we feel embarrassed about? Every single time you share something that feels really painful to you, it starts to become less painful. Or that's my hope. And then there's a lot of work that needs to be done around untangling what the retelling of a story is versus reliving it.
I love what you're saying. I mean, you're really embodying what I hope that we can support people with, which is going first with their story and shaking the shame off and really embracing it. And then as you've done, Tiffany, so well, ushering people into that freedom as well with Diversability. I think that's so beautiful. How can we get involved with Diversability, and how can we also just help in our communities reshape the narrative around what you said earlier about the not highlighting the negative, but really embracing the positive? How can we do that?
Right. So the first is, how can you support our work? And this has never been the Diversability Show. You can follow us on social media. If you don't follow other disabled people, at least start having more disability content show up on your feed wherever you are. But I will also say that I just really wish, my wish is that I really just want people to be more disability-centered in their work. Even if I look at what is happening right now with police reform, are we thinking about what de-escalation looks like if a person has a disability, right? Because it's always the opposite. And if we don't have a chance to explain, like, oh, I'm deaf, or, oh, I have cerebral palsy and I can't get to the floor quickly, or, you know, I have a paralyzed arm. If we're not really given those opportunities for de-escalation, then we kind of are growing up, and this is why we are where we are now. We grow up in a violent society. So that's kind of the first is, and this is like the lowest hanging fruit, is how can you get more disability content showing up? And everyone that Diversability is following right now is a Black disabled person or a Black owned business. So we're also trying to center ourselves on Black disabled content creators and trying to elevate those voices within our community. So then you talked about how can we kind of bring some of these, or you asked how can we bring some of these learnings back into our own community and see our narratives as more empowering. And this is where kind of the slow and hard work happens, right? It's, Jess, you and I met 5 years ago. You actually interviewed me to become one of the global shapers, but we met through Dreamers and Doers. Is that now that you know me, you know that there are other narratives than the things that you're seeing in the movies or the things that get shared on social media or those viral videos that make you cry. And my hope is that when people meet me or they meet other disabled people who are just living their best lives, like we're not here to make you cry. So the one of the best ways to tackle any type of bias is through real life continuous experiences with people who challenge your stereotypes. How can we get non-disabled and disabled people coming together, democratize these stories? Then you get to know us, you become friends with us, we become your partners, we become your friends. We're no longer, oh, I knew this person who had a paralyzed arm, or I knew this wheelchair user once upon a time, right? It's like, oh, I know Tiffany. Tiffany does all these other things. One of the other interesting things is I try and do this on social media, but I try and talk about like dating and stuff. Like, how can I add some of these more human elements to the disability experience, to as a human experience? I still need human connection. Just because I'm disabled doesn't mean I'm asexual, right? It's challenging a lot of these like dehumanizing messages. But yeah, I'll also acknowledge that you have access to rooms that I don't.
I'm so glad that you're mentioning all these other ways to support the community. And I'm just thinking through my own language and I'm like, wow, I'm realizing how in ways that, even I've done it and talked, kind of framed everything through the negative, which, it's just so humbling. I'm so glad you're mentioning that.
And I have as well. I used to call my arm my funny arm. And it was kind of meant as like a joke, but now I've moved away from that because by calling my arm a funny arm, I'm kind of like disassociating it from my body. And I recognize that I have a lot of internalized ableism that I'm still unlearning. And even now, as all of us look into doing more anti-racist work in our own lives or are confronted with that, I'm still doing that from a disability perspective as well. So for everyone, it's like we are all learning. As long as you keep moving, it's okay. And no one is intentionally trying to use, because the examples I gave you just were like, a lot of people are describing the pandemic as crazy, or a lot of people will talk about their blind spots. But again, when we use disability terms as bad words, then we're further perpetuating the narrative that disability is a bad thing and that there's stigma. So being blind or falling on deaf ears, you know, all of those things are further perpetuating stigma.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we can check out your website at www.diversibility.com.
Right. I'm so bad at promoting ourselves. So yeah, so you can find us at mydiversibility.com. We are at Diversibility across all the social media channels. If you want to follow me personally, my website is just my first and last name.com, TiffanyU.com. And then you can find me across social media at I'm Tiffany U. That's the letter I, the letter M, and my first and last name.
Tiffany is so inspiring. Definitely check out her own stuff as well. I know she's a little shy about it. And I totally see you wanting to promote the community, but I just want to plug that you are so inspiring on your own and the community exists because of you. So that, I guess, is just part of our own journey because I struggle with that as well. But you are such a powerful woman. Thank you so much for joining us. This is, again, so special. I adore you.
As I you. This was so fun. Thank you.
See you next time.
I'm Jessica Minhas, and thanks for joining us on I'll Go First. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Our mission is to uplift and support you in your journey of healing. If you like what you heard, please subscribe, comment, and share. And if there's a topic you'd like us to dive deeper into or would like to share your story with us, we are available on all major platforms at I'll Go First and www.illgofirst.com. We'll see you next time.